This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 57 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim is the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
I'm pretty good, actually. Hello, everybody.
And I'm delighted to welcome back Gareth Stringer, the Executive Editor at Global Aviation Resource. Gareth, fantastic to have you back.
Oh, it's good, very good to be back, believe me. Thank you very much, Peter, and thanks to everybody who knew what would happen the last few weeks for all their kind messages and everything. But yeah, you can't get rid of me that easily.
We're also joined by Rich Cooper from the Centre of Aviation Photography. Rich is an internationally recognised professional photographer and journalist. He's a senior correspondent for Combat Aircraft magazine and undertakes UK and European submissions for J-Wings, Pacific Wings and Aero magazine. He's been a member of the Royal International Air Tattoo photographic team for nearly 20 years and has also been the editor of Combat Aircraft magazine. In 2012, Rich was the finalist in the Professional Photographer of the Year and the winner of Action and Extreme Professional Photographer of the Year 2014. Rich, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much indeed. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. With a long list of credits like that, there's lots of questions coming your way about photographing aircraft.
Good stuff.
In today's show, we'll talk to Rich about all things aviation photography. We also get the chance to ask a few questions from photographer Paul Fidion. Whilst Paul was on the line, I also got the chance to speak to him about his latest book, The History of the Biggin Hill International Airfare. We also talked to Mike Young about Aircrow Interview. Tim has got a new X10 Top 10. We've got books to give away and we've got posters to give away as well. Along with feedback and promoting aerospace, this show today is fully loaded. Now, just before we start, I wanted to give a mention to our show supporters, Eventfire Solutions, who you've heard many times on the show over the past year. They've been a massive help to us in providing equipment and helping us to improve the recording experience. We want to thank Tony, Paul, Steve and Gaynor for all their help and support for the show. Now, if you work for a company that you think can benefit from health and safety as well as fire and risk analysis, please do support EFS. This really is how it all works. Also, if you like the fact that Eventfire Solutions are a recognisable business to you from hearing them here on Extended, then maybe your company could benefit from the exposure we can give you. If you're interested in supporting the programme, please do get in touch. If not, and you still want to help us and keep this content running, then we also have a donate button on our webpage. That is, of course, aviation-extended.co.uk. So let's get started by what's caught our eye in the news. Okay, first story on the list is from the Daily Telegraph. It's been rattling around in social media for last week or two, Tim. The drone hits a British Airways aeroplane. Didn't turn out to be a drone, though, did it?
I noticed you came straight to me on that one.
I did. I did.
Okay, so unless you've been living under a rock in the past week or so, yeah, there's a big scare when an A320 came in at Heathrow, and the pilot reported what he thought was a consumer drone about 1,500 feet up in the air. Plane landed safely. It was inspected, and no one found any damage, and flew on to its next destination. And it's now turned out that it might not have been a drone after all, and the culprit being possibly being a plastic bag. So, on one hand, it's kind of like one of these things of media scare story, gets shared round, people start panicking. Well, not panicking, but amplified and all the rest of it. And people start saying, this is the first recorded drone hit, mid-air collision. But it does actually, highlight, the serious problem we have of only a couple of days before, there was a video which just was gobsmacking if you knew anything about the drone rules, of somebody flying a consumer drone as high as the Shard Tower in London, right over the Heli Lanes, right over Trafalgar Square, Leicester Square. Heading over towards Buckingham Palace, and as high as a helicopter. So it's one of those things that it's not if it happens, it's when it happens and what's going to be the result.
Yeah, and BALPA, the British Airline Pilots Association, have stepped in, and there's been a lot of other trade bodies now saying something needs to be done about this. And although this British Airways incident was proved to be incorrect, as you say, this other incident has raised the heckles across London. And of course, we've recently had Barack Obama visiting the UK, and there was closure of large parts of airspace as a result of that. And one of the biggest fears was, of course, drones flying in that airspace. So a big issue, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one. What do you do? Do you register? But then if you register people's drones, does that mean that, if little Johnny goes to, or little Jane goes to Toys R Us, that they have to fill in a form and get a G registration for their toy drone from Toys R Us?
Well, that's what they've done in the US, haven't they? They've got a registration system. Is it proving successful, Tim? I've not heard...
They've seemed to have registered quite a few in a short period of time, but I'm still unclear as how you define what's the cutoff point for kind of something that is a toy and something that is a gadget perhaps or a commercial drone. So
I think that's been the clear point. There isn't anything clear up to now. You're asking the question, and we kind of know a little bit about the business, and we don't know. So, having that sort of thing happen as a scare probably will clarify some of the rules around it. And I think from what I've seen of photographers using drones, it's the moment it becomes commercial, i.e., the moment you're using the drone to make money, that's when you cross a different threshold. But that's quite easy to police in a way. But the problem is that the technology is rapidly increased with that law. So even those, that you can just buy over the counter, you wouldn't necessarily have any thought of using anything commercial, are now so powerful and can fly so high and are so big that, the law has to be kind of changed or altered, I think, to keep up with technology.
Very much so. Well, let's move on. Let's continue to talk about policing, Gareth. I'm going to bring the next story to you. The Americans have been buzzed a fair bit. We've seen a lot of coverage again on social media about this. This is the Sukhoi 24 fencers. How common is this?
Well, it has been reported before. It was reported, funnily enough, the destroyer in question is the USS Donald Cook. This happened a couple of weeks ago from the time of recording, back in 12th and then 13th of April in the Baltics. It was in international waters. It was the same ship, also reported flybys from an SU-24 back in April of 2014, just a couple of years ago. A real sort of throwback to the Cold War, though, with some pretty jaw-dropping footage. I mean, these aircraft were very low. They were very fast, and probably most importantly, they were very close to the ship in question. It was reported possibly as close as 30 feet from the side of the ship. They weren't carrying any external stores. You'd have to pause the video to see it because they're going so bloody quickly. And they were low enough at times to actually create sort of wake on the seawater. So, very, very aggressive. And yeah, as I say, a real sort of throwback to the Cold War, and it made, you know, it made big news. And it didn't just happen a couple of times either. There were, you know, possibly as many as 20 overflights on one day, and then sort of 11 the next. So that's not somebody out there thinking, oh, you know, I'll have a bit of fun, you maybe make a couple of passes. That's you know, it's fairly persistent, isn't it? Quite aggressive.
Is there any evidence of Western air forces doing the same thing in return?
Well, we used to do that in the Cold War. I mean, there's great shots of there's a great shot that is on I saw on social media a couple of days afterwards of a Lynx with a big camera ball getting a very up close and personal with a Russian ship, and obviously, you know, buccaneers but I think in those days, because of the Cold War, the rules got kind of established of you know, what you could and you couldn't do over time, and you know, this has sort of come out a little bit, well, not out of the blue, as Gareth says, but it's you know, we haven't got that sort of foundation of it being a regular occurrence. So yeah, it's kind of...
It was, for me, it was quite shocking to see it, but I have to confess, equally, maybe this is wrong, but maybe it's the enthusiast in me, it's actually quite thrilling as well to see, you know what I mean?
Because this isn't an
everyday... you know, event anymore, and rightly so. The you know, the US Defense Department was not amused, and I don't blame them for that at all, but some spectacular footage.
Did I see some mention today in the press of an American officer suggesting they should return the favor? I'm sure I saw something about that earlier today, but we shall see. We'll watch this one with interest. Let's move on to Asia. Then we've just seen at point of recording a few days ago that Japan has flown its first stealth fighter demonstrator from defenseaerospace.com. Tim, she looks pretty well, but I think Gareth suggests she looks like something else.
Is it only me that thinks this? I don't know. Rich, I don't know if you were on with it. I think it looks like the Angel Interceptor from Captain Scarlet.
I'm way too young.
You wish.
Yeah. It's interesting news, isn't it, that they're pushing for this, and there are all sorts of legal reasons, Tim, why they have to had to start developing this, because they couldn't participate in some of the F-35 development. But is this realistically going to end up, do you think, in a combat fighter?
I think so. It's a demonstration at the moment, so we'll see. We'll have to see where it goes. You know, you have to remember, obviously, like you allude to there, the Japanese were mad keen on buying F-22, which was obviously, you know, even due to US closest allies, was you know, out of bounds. They're buying F-35, but they obviously have a requirement, and they also want to keep. You know, keep their technology and their industry up to the highest levels. So they are now the, you know, let's say US, China, Russia, fourth country to fly a stealth fighter.
Yep.
They have that kind of requirement. So I suspect that's more of a you know, an air superiority. Type than the F-35 is, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Well, the next story comes to us from SciNews.com. It's a space story and is all about SPEED, the breakthrough Starshot plan to Alpha Centauri. How exciting is this? 20% of the speed of light, they think that they can get a ship travelling across to the nearest star.
I think this is pretty exciting, actually. I mean, we had, there was a week where we had, you know, vertical landing of Falcon 9, you know, SpaceX. That was pretty exciting. If you saw that, that was like, wow, this is, you know, people were calling it an Apollo moment for millennials. And then this popped up, which was a Russian a billionaire, I think Facebook founder as well. And Professor Stephen Hawking. And what we're talking about here is using giant lasers to propel small nanocraft, like basically computer chips with sensors and a solar sail each, thousands of them. You release them in orbit and you fire a Wackenberg laser at them. That speeds them up to 20% of the speed of light, and you get there within 20 years. And if you think about kind of conventional ideas of how soon it would get to Alpha Centauri, 20,000 years or something like that. This is kind of really, really exciting. There's obviously kind of big. There's some still technology. Issues to overcome, and you know what happens if one of these things hits a sort of a grain of space dust on the way. Well, okay, it's 20% the speed of light. You can probably say goodbye to it. where do you put the laser as well? This thing is going to be a massive anti-satellite weapon in the wrong hands. So you've got to be certain that you're going to put it in the right place. And also, the Earth rotates. So how do you get around that as well? So it's not. There are challenges to overcome, but it is a plan that looks on the face of it, sort of achievable, and it's a breakthrough thing if you can get these things to Alpha Centauri, and also even closer, you could get it to, you can get these sort of like mini probes to Pluto or somewhere in just record time.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, not quite as far as Pluto or Alpha Centauri, but St. Helena, a thousand or so miles off of the coast of Africa, has just received its first large passenger jet flight. A British Airways 737 from, I think it was Cape Town, flew in for the first service, operated by Comair. We'll put a link in the show notes to the story, but fantastic picture. I love the livery of the aircraft. But quite a milestone for that little island, Tim.
That's one of the few, there are a few places on the planet now that haven't got some kind of airport or air service. So this is one of the sort of final links to link it with the rest of the world. And obviously they've got great hopes that it will attract tourism, boost their economy, all the good stuff that aviation brings everywhere else. And yeah, like you say, some great pics that of this Comair coming in and 737 coming in and sort of trying out the runway.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant stuff. So well done to everyone there. I noticed in the story that there was an investment from the British government as well in this, although predominantly it was financed by private organisations. I just wonder if it's strategically still of a little bit of importance to have that runway there. Good place to have one, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it could be. Yeah, I mean, you've obviously got Ascension there as well, but as a sort of like a we're thinking about.
Well, on that note, pondering that one, we'll take a little break, and then when we come back, we'll talk to Rich about the Centre of Aviation Photography.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Well, Rich, the Centre of Aviation Photography, we're going to come to that in a little while. I'm not quite sure where to start, though, with you. Do we start with aviation or do we start with photography?
They go hand in hand in my life. So
let's start with aeroplanes then. where did your interest in aviation come from?
Like so many people, actually, through my father. So, I've got shots of me at like 2 years old with Matchbox toys and Dinky toys, lining them up and making my own airfield and stuff, you know, in the back garden. So I was obviously into it in a really early age. But my dad was an enthusiast and photographer and journalist and worked in the industry as well. So that was always going to be kind of my destiny, I suppose. So right from an early age, he was taking me to air shows. I think my first one where I took a, you know, he gave me a camera to use alongside with him when I was seven. It was Farnborough in 82. And, you know, he sort of like just showed me what to do and how to do it. And then rock and roll from there, really. And I then got my own camera. And I actually then got my first picture published when I was 11. So, you know, it was quite, quite an early start on that. But it was so different back then. You know, the opportunities, it was endless. And the obviously the security picture as well was very different. So with my dad as a kind of well-known, recognised journalist himself, he was going into RAF stations and whatever and reporting on the news that was happening or exercises and whatever. And he could literally ring up the base and the station officers and et cetera and just say, look, you know, I'd like to bring my son along. Is that okay? And they were like, yeah, sure. You know, it was just such a different place back then, you know, so it was just a lot easier to get into. So yeah, I shadowed him for a long time basically, and then I got to the point where I wanted to do it as a career, and I thought, well, the best place to do that is really to combine my love of aviation and photography is to go into the RAF as a photographer, realizing obviously it was a little bit more just a bit more than just photographing aeroplanes in that role, but you know, it's something that I really wanted to do and just be embedded in the Air Force and cover their daily operations of man and machine and everything else, from, you know, kind of handshakes and flower ceremonies to fast jet deployments and everything else. It was really something I wanted to do, so I went for it. And then SDR kicked in and all the cutbacks and everything else, and they culled the service significantly. So they told me I could do air traffic. I was like, okay, it's not really what I want to do, but so I said, okay, well, go away and do something useful, go and come back in a couple of years basically, so when the situation might be a bit clearer as to our recruitment plan. So I went to work in a camera shop. I was only like 16 still at the time, and it was great. It's the local independent camera shop that's still going now, one of the only ones left in the country in Farnborough. And I worked there for a number of years, and it taught me the kind of the breadth of photography. You know, there's the different manufacturers, what their kind of way of thinking was like, and you know, the innovations they're all coming up with, all the different systems and everything else, and also really importantly, how to deal with with people, the irate customers, and the phone calls and everything else. So I did that for a couple of years while I waited to hear back from the RAF. And then when I did go back to the RAF, my life had kind of moved on quite a bit, and I was just loving working in this photographic environment. And it just wasn't really the right time and place. I think, just life circumstances had changed. So I carried on working there at the shop. And then I got a job with a company called Air Claims, which is based at London Heathrow. And they provided data to airlines, like an airline manufacturers, etc., of what was happening in the industry. So I was reporting on the industry as a whole, you know, what airlines were doing, what manufacturers were developing, what, who was buying what, who was putting what into storage, etc., etc. And I was quickly became responsible for I think it's about six publications or something like that. There was a couple of annual publications. There was a biannual, a monthly, and a weekly that I became editor of within a couple of years, sort of thing. And it was whilst that I was on reporting on a Swedish airline called Malmö Aviation that had just bought 146s, back then, that I met the editor of Aircraft Illustrated. He was on the same press trip as I was, and we got on like a house on fire whilst eating reindeer steaks up in Sweden. It was fantastic. And his assistant editor at the time was going travelling. And we, as I say, got on really well with the editor. And he said, there's a possible job here for you. My assistant editor's going away. Do you want to come for an interview? So I did, and the interview consisted of talking about what music I liked, and that was about it. it was great. I owe a lot to Alan Burney. He was, fantastic guy, fantastic friend, and I really learned a lot working with him when I then eventually joined Aircraft Illustrated. So then I was lucky enough to turn that into a career for 10 years I was there. So I was deputy editor of Aircraft Illustrated and editor of Combat Aircraft. Bought it over from the States and made it into the kind of UK, European and American product that it is today. And so it was just an incredible period. And then I left in 2008. I left that role to a change of life circumstance. Again, I went and did a lot of charity work in the town I live in, but still continued the freelance stuff. And, you know, like I said, aviation photography is a big part of who I am. So although I was doing something very different, it still remained a very big part of my life. So I still kept my hand in, still did everything I was doing, but it just wasn't a job as such. So continued it freelance. And luckily enough, you know, obviously Jamie Hunter and I go way back to kind of short trousers and stuff, spotting outside airfields. So I continued my relationship with the magazines and all the contacts and everything else. And yeah, carried that on today. So built it into more of a full time.
Just let me jump in there. You've seen, I was thinking through some of the changes you've seen in technology. You've obviously seen the change from celluloid to digital, but you probably also have seen through the paper magazine to the digital magazine as well. How have you dealt with those as a photographer?
I actually think the digital aviation publishing has got a long way to go. I believe that whole industry is in transition at the moment. I think there's some great products out there, and there's some great magazines out there, some great media products out there as well. But I think the media side of things has got a long way to go. It's only just really realizing its potential, certainly in terms of like, you talk to, say, like a public affairs officer at a base when you're talking about doing an article, etc. And there's still very much the mentality of wanting to see it in print, which is quite interesting, whereas sometimes you get a real kind of like, okay, what's the reach of this? You know, because a magazine's going to give you X amount of thousands of reach. But if you're doing it for an online blog, for example, or, you know, if then the aviation publishing world catches up and really develops a fantastic online product that it could have the potential to do so, then you're talking hundreds of thousands of people. It's a totally different world, but it's not there yet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the Centre of Aviation Photography, and that's how I came across you. Cool. I know you've known Gareth for a while. We'll come back to talk about some of the stuff that's certainly out in particularly social media there, the stunning photography. But how did it start? What is it? How does it work?
It's probably to start with from the beginning again on that. So whilst I was at the magazine, I quickly noticed that, you know, I was building a lot of relationships up with a lot of military air arms. And there was one in particular. There was the Italian Air Force at Grazzanidze Air Base, and they were flying their last F-104s. And I was working over there a lot. You know, it was great. I think it was on my fourth trip over there that I said to the squadron, I said, like, you know, how about if I bring some of my readers with me? They'd love to see this. You know, your jet is something special. You know, and fortunately, the Italians knew they had something special on their hands. So they were very willing to let that happen. So I went and talked to the base commander and I said, you know, I'd like to bring some of my readers over here. How about it? This is in the early 2000s. And he said, yeah, sure. I won't do an Italian accent, you're right. But he said, yeah, sure, you know, the base is, you know, yeah, why not? He said, how many people are you thinking of? And I said, 40. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, 14. Yeah, well, I think we could do 14 people. And I said, yeah, no, 40. And he's like, okay, sure, you know, the base is big enough. We'll just get more pizzas. You know, it was like that. It really was. So I ended up taking, I think, 80-odd people over there over a couple of different trips, if not more, maybe 120 people. And it just went from there, really. So it started off as AI Reader's Tours. It was Aircraft Illustrated Reader's Tours. That was what the spark was. I basically thought, right, I can get people where they can't get because of my work within the magazine. So I would go to a base, go to a squadron, And not normally during an air show or an exercise or anything like that, because that's something I could see that, you know, the readers or whoever could probably do on their own. I was talking about, you know, witnessing life on the front line. That's what you just can't do, you know, really absorbing and getting embedded into a squadron. So as I was then going out and reporting on different things, it was in the early 2000s, there was a lot of things being retired. You know, there was the last Sea Harriers, the last Jags, the last Drakens, the last Viggens. The list is endless. So the last Phantom, you know, loads and loads. So I thought, well, if I'm going out there to do this, you know, why not take groups of our readers along with us and set up the photo club, which is what we did. So that ran, it was, you know, it was a great success. I can't remember the figures exactly, but there was a lot of trips undertaken up until I left the magazine in 2008. And obviously when I left, kind of that, the direction of the magazines changed. Obviously AI went the way it did, and combat is now much more of an industrial side of the aviation industry as well. So it didn't really fit the model anymore. So, but there was still a need out there for this to still happen. And whilst I was doing very different work, you know, within the charity world and stuff, I couldn't really do both. So I kind of shelved it for a bit, but I'd often hear whispers and rumours of people that had travel with me that really wanted me to get back up and running with something similar again. So fast forward now to about 2 years ago, and I thought, well, you know, I could see the time was about right. You know, there's a lot of things disappearing, the opportunities are getting less and less for people at a time when actually the hobby's growing, it's increasing, you know, everyone's got access to photography, and which is a good thing. But at the same time, the security environment and the opportunities because of the manpower are getting less and less and less and less. So it's really hard to get something exclusive. Whereas I still felt pretty confident I could do that. So the spark really was then, aside from people were asking me to get on and do it, was that digital photography had exploded. You know, back when I was doing it in the early 2000s, there was probably, I don't know, maybe 30% of the people that were in that setup that were digital, something like that. Maybe 40, 50 tops. But, you know, there was this massive wave of digital photography and social media and post-processing and the whole industry we know and love today that wasn't really harnessed in any way. You know, there was lots of things being developed and lots of styles and niches and everything else, which is fantastic, but there was no kind of umbrella in which to put it all underneath. So I thought, well, you know, why not reestablish what I was doing before, you know, getting the access with quality media results, but also bringing along the new wave of photographers, if you like, and everyone that's been doing it for so long as well, you know, being able to hone their skills and pass on those skills to a new generation at the same time.
So in terms of that whole skills related side of what you do, what sort of advice, guidance, teaching do you give to people who come along on the courses?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's CURAP is split into kind of four arms, really. You've got the obvious one, which is the assignments, where you go onto a live airfield, you're embedded into a squadron generally, and it, you know, usually outside of an exercise or an air show or anything like that, it's about absorbing squadron life, and you're literally on the front line. So that's one of the arms. The other arm is the workshops, where it's specific classroom teaching. Another one is the photo shoots, where it's a dedicated photo shoot of an aircraft or different types of aircraft. And the other one is yet to be developed, which is the seminar side of things as well. So it's currently operating on those three, with the most popular being obviously the assignment side of things. But what I tend to look at that as not just, I've always said, you know, if you look at the website and everything else, it's not just about the access. You know, you are absorbing the approach of a professional photographer, you know, and it's not just me. There's obviously other guys on there as well that have been doing it just as long as I have. And, you know, the guy I run it with as well, Steve Comber, he's also a professional photographer. So, you know, you're getting, if you come away with us for a week, you know, you're not going to just an airbase for a week. You're on a week's worth of total immersion of aviation photography, morning, noon and night. You know, it's not just what you're doing around the base itself. You know, I'm constantly on hand. I'm constantly spilling my guts as to what happens, when, why, how, what am I doing it, why am I doing it like that, what do I do with the images afterwards. So it's a real immersion in the whole setup.
And your students, for want of a better description, your students publish their material and share their material on your Facebook group and things like that. Stunning photography. I have to ask the question for me, I'm sure not for the others on the call, but do you do a beginner's class?
Yeah, honestly, it's open to all. It really is. I encourage anyone to come along. It's quite interesting question, actually, because a big part of kind of who I am in terms of how I operate within this whole setup is that obviously there's a very strong media angle to it all. You know, it's sometimes it is about just raising money for a local station charity, and that's it, and that's fine, and that's the end result. But I'm very, very highly encouraging people to not just have images sitting on hard drives. So if your end result is putting pictures on your walls, then I want those pictures to be the best possible they could be. If it's populating your social media and everything else, then I want you to have as many followers and as much interest and as much conversation going around your images that you've shot on a carap trip as possible to develop you and boost you as a photographer. If your end result is you want to get published, then you're talking to the right person. That's what I do. That's who I am. So, you know, if you've never written it before, if you've done loads and just want to try a different magazine and a different approach, then Carap enables all of that. You know, there's about three or four, I think, from the last 6 months of brand new published authors that I kind of mentored through the experience. So they had no idea how to write an article. So it's actually a really hard thing. You know, if you could.
So, Rich, you talk about writing there, and I do know from your work, and obviously you've explained to us your career. We've seen some of your material published recently, and there's been a great deal of interest in the Hogs and Frogs.
Sure,
that particular item on combat aircraft. You're training people then not only to take the photographs, but to write about the experience as well.
Yeah definitely. I mean, there's kind of two parts to that. Is the experience, as you say, that we could put into blogs or your own websites and everything else as well, but it's generally I will be talking to a unit about what they're doing and why they're doing it. So there'll be specific news to come out of a unit. For example, perfect example is the Discovery Air Defence visit we did to Vitman last year. You know, I think that was published in five magazines in the end, five different magazines, five different countries with three brand new authors. So they got the story, they were in part of the briefing, they took the notes, and I'm obviously, you know, prepping them and teaching them all of how to do all that, and then translating all of that along with their images into a magazine article. And that's what breaks you through as a photographer. If you want that, you know, not everyone wants it, let's face it, you know, that sometimes it's just for them, and that's cool. But if you want that, then it's a really hard industry to break into. So you know, Carap is very much about the end result, and sometimes it's not necessarily like one of the most recent end results we did was with the 493rd Fighter Squadron at Lakenheath. You know, there's not an awful lot that could be written about that unit that hasn't been written already. I mean, they're obviously a very busy unit and they're always doing stuff, so it would be an angle. But I really wanted to go to that unit and say, right, you know, you guys are always away, you've got families and everything else. I want to produce a book for you that shows your family and your friends what you do as your day job. So let's embed these guys into your squadron daily life for 2 days, and we'll produce a book on your life as a Grim Reaper pilot that you can use for, you know, your own use, and obviously public affairs as well, being able to use it as a PR tool for themselves as well.
Yeah.
Rich.
Okay.
Rich, quick question. Are you not worried that you, by training up a new generation of apprentices, you might actually do yourself out of a job?
that's some sort of good managerial work ethic, I think, isn't it? I don't know. I think there's enough room for everyone.
Rich, let's talk some technical aspects of aviation photography then. What do you see as a lot of people are listening to this wanted to know how to take better photographs of aircraft, be they static, moving, or in the air. What are the sorts of challenges that you think really opposed by aviation photography?
I think at the moment there's a real challenge to make something stand out, because you are absolutely flooded by images every single day. You know, you just need to pick up your phone and thumb through it on the screen or whatever. And, you know, we probably look at thousands of images a day. So being able to get an image that grabs someone's attention for more than 2 seconds is a result nowadays. So that's a big challenge.
Right. Okay. And in terms of some of the technical aspects of the camera work that you do, things like lighting and that sort of thing, what sort of advice can you give to some of our listeners to take some better shots and to try and stand out a little bit more?
I suppose the way to look at that is to define what is a better shot, and there's certain things that are really important, you know, like your focusing, your exposure, your angles and proximity and composition and all that kind of stuff. But the bottom line is it's a form of art. So if you like out of focus pictures, then you're going to say that's a good shot. So it's very, very subjective, very subjective.
Right, and
there are, of course, you know, I was being joking around a bit there, but there are specific things that there's probably around, I mean, I teach in the workshops. I won't say too much now because I would like people to come on the workshops. But, you know, I've got like about 2 hours of discussion around what makes a good shot. It's a subjective thing. But, the bottom line is that if you've taken a photograph that someone can look at and think, wow, I wish I'd taken that, or I want to know how they took that, then you're onto a winner. So that's really is the bottom line. It's so subjective, but within the realms of, you know, making sure it's in focus, etc., etc. So I really encourage people to experiment, to be honest. You know, get it off the auto mode. You can't break anything, you can't do anything wrong. It's your photography, and you've got to develop, in order to make yourself stand out, you've got to develop your own style of photography, but also own style of post-processing nowadays, and that's what will make you stand out.
Rich, you can spend an absolute fortune on camera equipment. We all know that. But you don't have to, do you?
Not at all. No, not at all. I'm having big discussions this week, actually, about iPhone photography. It's something I absolutely love. It's you know, aside from the actual, obviously, main kit, it's my my favourite bit of kit in my bag's my iPhone. You don't need the kit. You need to spend as much money as you can on the lenses. That's the important thing, because there used to be a time, you know, back when I was working at the shop, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there was a time when manufacturers were putting out bad, real dogs out there, you know, really bad. But technology is now such that you don't really get that anymore. You know, there's no really bad cameras out there, especially if you're sticking with the main, you know, main brand names. But, you know, so you've really then got to think, okay, well, the sensor's going to be okay. There's the more money you spend on a sensor, the better it is. That's obvious. But generally, they are okay. So, but you can get the best sensor in the world and put a milk bottle on it, and it's still going to be rubbish. So, spend money on the glass.
Yeah,
Rich, what then is in your camera bag? What are your main items?
So, I use Nikon. That's my dad's fault as well on that one. I started off as a Praktika man actually back in the day. Then went to Minolta very quickly. Minolta were fantastic back in their day. They were the best that you could ever have for aviation photography, and I could talk to you all night about why that was good and what their innovative technology brought to the game of aviation photography, but that's probably another topic. But so I went to Nikon when Minolta gave up the ghost. They were too late going into the digital world, and they got taken over by Konica and Minolta, then Sony, and it just didn't really happen at the top end for them. So yeah, they were good, but you know, Canon and Nikon totally stole the market. So I went with Nikon because my dad does, so I can nick all his lenses, basically, bottom line. He doesn't listen, so I can say that. He might listen now, though. I use a Nikon D3S and a D300. I'm very pleased that Nikon have now bought out the D500, which is, you know, obviously the long-awaited replacement for the D300 workhorse. So, yeah.
And what about lenses?
So I'm a big believer in making sure that you've got as little gaps in your coverage as possible. You know, it's Sod's law that if you've got a 28 to 70 and then you've got, say, 100, 300, everything you're going to need to be shooting is in that 80 to 100 gap. So I'm a real big believer in making sure you've got as little gaps as possible, especially nowadays that, again, zoom lenses, the technology in them is so much better. Of course, they're not going to be as good as a prime lens. That's a given. But, yeah, you know, they are good nowadays. So, yeah, I've got everything from 11 mil to 750 mil on a crop. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions now we want to ask everyone. What's your favourite photograph you've taken?
Oh man. Can I have a minute to think about that?
Okay, I'll ask you the next one then. What they're going to come thick and fast. What's the most challenging aviation photo to take?
That I've taken or in general?
In general.
It sounds an obvious one, and it's a bit of a kind of it is the air-to-air stuff, you know, because there is so much going on, you know, not only in terms of actually taking the photograph, which, you know, is often challenging enough, but just the physical elements of it, you know, the physical dynamics of being in a four-dimensional world, you're just not used to it. And my hat is constantly doffed to the professional aviation photographers that fly a lot. You know, they are robots. I'm terrible in the air. I'm a lot better than I was, but the human dynamics of being in the air is very, very physically demanding. So you've got that side of things, you've got taking the photograph side, but then you've got the planning and the execution, and there's so many planets that have got a line to get it right. You know, you've got serviceability, you've got weather, you've got airspace, you've got just the authority, the approvals, the paperwork, everything has got to align before you even get in that cockpit. So that is the most, you know, we see air-to-air images all the time, you know, we're some incredible photographers out there, but the image is literally 10% of the work.
Right. And just putting that into context then, the photos I mentioned earlier, the A10 and the Sukhoi 25s that mm-hmm. you shot, what did you shoot them from? What were you in?
A hill.
Right. That's amazing then, because
the
they look like...
Bulgarian foothills.
They look like air-to-air.
They do, yeah. Someone else told me that. It's amazing. If you look at the front cover of the current combat, you can see that's a much more obvious that it's low level.
Right. Okay.
I remember thinking, right, I've got all the shots nailed. I'm going to drop that down to about, I think it's 1/80th of a second, something like that, on a 500mm lens, and got one that really, you know, conveyed the movement and everything else. So yeah, they are up a very high hill that took about an hour to climb. Well, it's not really a hill, it's sort of like a mini mountain, really. I'm just going to big it up. It's probably tiny and it just took me an hour. But no, it was quite a climb. And it was that illustrates the point perfectly, because, you know, the planning involved, oh my goodness. We're talking months, probably 4 months to get that to happen.
Wow. Okay. We'll share some links in the show notes that.
Yeah,
but I just want to ask you one final question, and then we want to talk about some of the events you've got coming up on Co-op. Just one final one to throw out there. I haven't forgotten about your favourite photograph, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. What's your best tip?
My best tip? I don't think I can stick to one. Is that right?
Yeah. Go.
So I would say, got to take the camera off auto. Definitely, you know, get it doesn't matter if not necessarily, you know, when you're at rear and the F-35 is landing for the first time, you know, do what you need to do. But just I really encourage people to just take it off auto, really get to know how the camera works, you know, put it to manual, learn your apertures, learn your depth of field, learn your shutter speed, learn your ISO settings, all of that. And then it really gives you a handle on what the camera's doing and how it's thinking, so that you can, if you need to, then override it, and it'll develop your photography massively. So on that kind of taking that a step further is to really spend time on the camera's weaknesses, you know, or your weaknesses. You know, if you struggle with, say, night photography, or you struggle with panning action at slow speeds or whatever that may be, really spend time on those things. We can all take a great picture, you know, a sunny day with the aircraft standing in front of us. But, you know, when it's raining, it's chucking it down, or you've got the wrong lens on, or you've got, you know, when there's a real challenge in front of you, that's when you're really going to need to know what you're doing. So I'd definitely spend as much time as you can on your weaknesses. I'd say also to develop your own style within that. Like, you know, I touched on earlier, we are bombarded with images, and to make yourself stand out, you really do have to do something a bit different, either in what you're taking or how you're taking it, or how you're post-processing it. So yeah, develop your own style is really important. And then in terms of getting the access and finding new opportunities, I think, you know, there's two areas I would say there that people would really benefit from, perhaps if they want to go that way, is to first of all really build relationships. You know, everything I do is based on relationship. Very, very rarely am I cold calling someone and, you know, they're a complete stranger to me. I'm always using contacts that I've spent years working on. So it's a slow burn, and it always will be, but the results will be worth it in the end on that. And then once you get there and you're in place and doing your thing, don't bite the hand that feeds you, you know, and really look after your hosts is really, really important.
All right. Okay. A couple of questions. To just wrap up the Q&A then, from listeners. Tumbles on Twitter says, what do you think is the best lens and f-stop combo? He's thinking of adding an 85mm f2.8 lens to his kit.
Superb. It's an awesome lens. Absolutely brilliant. It's a bit limited in terms of aviation, you know, because it's kind of like not wide enough for static and not long enough for flying. So you'll get some amazing pilot stuff though if you're going to use that at the 2.8 lens. It's going to be a fixed lens at 85mm, so you know the quality of the glass in that is going to be superb, and you'll get some lovely portrait pictures of pilots doing their thing. So you know, one of the challenges at air shows is to try and find something different, but the pilots are always there. They're always willing. They want to pose for you. So you know, get them to do it. Get them to sit in the cockpit and put it on 2.8 and get a lovely shallow depth of field and play around with it. So yeah, it could be a really different way of making your images stand out. But you have to work a little bit harder on the static stuff to get some decent stuff. But that's okay. But I wouldn't recommend that for the flying. That'd be a little bit too small.
Okay. Avgeek Joe, also on Twitter, wants to know some tips on how to photograph helicopters.
Okay, so the biggest challenge on that is obviously to try and make it look as if it's not a model, i.e. not freezing the rotor blades. And that is a challenge, you know, that is a hard thing to do. So drop the shutter speed down, and that may be something that you're going to need to practice on. But anything below 200 is worth going for. There's a bit of a rule of thumb that you shouldn't go below the maximum lens length. So, i.e. if you're using a 200mm, then don't go below 200th of a second, because it becomes harder to shoot, harder to keep still. But, you know, with VR, the vibration reduction and image stabilization nowadays, they're amazing. You know, I've handheld stuff at a fifth of a second, you know, if not less, a third of a second, I think I did the other day on helicopters. It's phenomenal. So really play around with your VR settings if you're Nikon, or I think it's, I can't remember the Canon one. I should remember that.
It's IS, isn't it?
It is IS. Yeah, okay, yeah. Thanks, mate. So, yeah, play around with those and go as low as possible on your shutter speed. But the bottom line is get it sharp, because you can have a lovely, lovely blurred rotor blade and it will all look amazing, and you maybe even get a full disc, but the fuselage is completely out of focus, so it's pretty useless. So go as low as you can possibly go, but that only comes with practice.
Right, okay. You answered his next question about getting published and getting paid for your work. I think he needs to come on one of your workshops.
Yeah, I'll tell him all about that, definitely.
And finally, just some advice on shutter speeds, I think. I think you've answered a few of those, you brought a few points up there. But generally, what are the do's and don'ts there?
The most important thing is keeping it sharp. You know, that is the number one rule, really. If it's sharp, if it's out of focus, then it's you know, there's not really a lot you can do. So The good thing is nowadays that sensors in cameras are very, very good at high ISO. They're getting better all the time on that. So if you need to use a, you know, if there's tricky lighting and everything else, whack the ISO up and keep the shutter speed low. That's much better.
Right. Okay. Well, let's come back to Co-op. You've got some very, very exciting events coming up. Do you just want to give a flavour for the sorts of events you're going to be running through the rest of this year?
Yeah, it's actually a really busy end to the year. We had intended to spread it out a little bit more than it has worked thus far, but you know, beggars can't be choosers, really. If I'm talking to a frontline military unit and they say you can't come until the second half of the year because we're on deployment, then that's kind of the world I'm operating in. So it has all bunched up a little bit towards the end of the year, but you know, yeah, it's going to be incredibly busy. We've got a lot of UK stuff happening, but there's also, I think, there's going to be about 3 US trips in the space of about 6 weeks or 7 weeks. So like September and October is going to be nonstop.
Just in terms of a flavour, we're talking A-10s in Arizona, we're talking U-2s in Beale, and even possibly the a trip to China I see as well on the list.
Yeah, China will be the Zhuhai Air Show, and that's a good example of where Co-op offers something different. Because obviously you can go to Zhuhai, you know, you could get a ticket and work it out yourself, but it's quite a hard country to do that in if you've never been, and there's some pretty exotic, tasty aeroplanes to train your lenses on there. So we'll be there doing that, but I've got, you know, obviously contacts in China as well, and we'll be hopefully hooking up with a couple of well-known photographers to do some workshops whilst we're there, because obviously it's an industry show, it's a big show out there, it attracts a lot of the big names in the business, so I'll be able to pull some of those together in the hotel after a day shooting at the air show to talk about their career and their life and how they approach photography. So that's more of the air show side of things, how we make a standard event that little bit different. But then you've got the other end of the spectrum, which will be, you know, frontline guns blazing, quite literally, in terms of the A-10 visit, where we'll be, like I said earlier, embedded in the squadron, and very much looking forward to that.
Right,
Rich. A quick question for me, Rich. Yeah. Is the North Korean trip on?
I hope so. I really would.
The Air Show and Beer Festival.
Indeed, what an incredible event. At the moment, it's on pause. The missile testings they've done have resulted in some pretty heavy sanctions that obviously before, whilst the event was being planned and whilst the travel, etc., was being planned, that no one could foresee. Obviously, it's that kind of country, so you're never quite sure what they're going to come up with next. But that has caused some pretty heavy sanctions, one of them, in fact, being aviation fuel. So right now, that event is paused, but the There's the worldwide travel agent for that event is actually out in North Korea in the next couple of weeks. So he's getting first-hand reports back from Wonsan, and we'll know exactly what's happening. But I've already got a replacement tour lined up to an incredible place if Baltics. That doesn't go through. No, I've already done that one. Did that last year. May return there, but this will be Russian hardware.
Ooh, exciting.
Yes, it will exciting. Be very good, yeah.
Well, Rich, I think we're going to need to just wrap up there. Sure. Where can we find out about Co-op online?
So the main website is all the W's and then centreofaviationphotography.com. We're also obviously on Facebook, and there's quite an active community on Facebook, which is just facebook.com/ aviation. Oh, no, it's not. Apologies for that. Do you want the actual address for that?
No, I think if you put Centre of Aviation Photography,
it will
come
up. Find it. Yeah,
I can put the group in the show notes as well.
Okay,
excellent.
Perfect. And then on Twitter as at Co-op Photo.
Well, that has been fascinating. I think we'd like to get you back sometime, Rich, to talk
Lovely.
Some more.
Yeah, Rich,
can I ask you one quick question?
Of course you can. Anything, mate.
We've all. Kind of doesn't matter how long you've been taking pictures of aircraft these days. We've all seen aircraft retire.
Yeah.
But going back to pre-digital, if you had the old ability to turn back the clock, is there anything that you never got to shoot in digital that you would dearly love to have been able to sort of unleash the technology that's available
oh,
now
man.
Upon? And you can only name one thing.
Oh, man. That's harsh. Probably a trip I did to Sweden to see the Viggens.
Okay.
Yeah, that was more or less my last full slide trip. Yeah. And the technology was rapidly catching up. A few guys there, and I look back on that now and think, wow, yeah, I wish that had happened. But I've got to say that it would have been the last ever Tomcat cruise, because although I was on digital, it was my first digital camera. So,
okay.
You know, it was kind of it was pretty rough. It was that 6 megapixels, and you know, anything above maybe 200 ISO was super noisy, and it was getting affected by the radar. Because we were in combat ops, the radar on the island was going around, and you got streaks across the sensor and all sorts. So yeah, I'd love to go back and do that. I've got some great stuff. It's all fine, you know. It was a great trip, but yeah, I'd love to do that again.
Good stuff.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the Society and the world at large and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Last week, I got to talk to journalist and photographer Paul Fidion about aviation photography and his latest book, The History of the Biggin Hill International Airfare. Journalist, author, photographer, Paul Fidion, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
No, delighted to have you, Paul. The last time I saw you, we were at Yeovilton and sitting in a Sea King, and I was trying to get you to take a photo of me sitting in the cab. But no. as I sat at the weekend reading through my copy of Flypast, I saw a picture. I thought, oh, that looks interesting, that looks familiar, and I read the article, Yeovilton's Farewell to the Sea King, and it was your article with your photo of the Mark IV. Great photo, by the way.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Paul, you're a pretty handy photographer. What makes a good aviation or air show photograph in your eyes?
I think that's a pretty big topic, to be honest. One thing I always like to see, I mean, the aircraft are the stars. You know, you go to air shows and I'm there really for the aircraft. I want to be absolutely clear. I love the social side, but the aircraft are the big pull. So I want to photograph them. But I also want something that shows me maybe in a few years when I look back. I want to see what the show was about as well. So I'm quite fond of photographs with the public in, with the crowd. That could be static or flying, to be fair. And
yeah.
I want the atmosphere to come across as much as the aircraft themselves.
Yeah, I really get that, Paul. That gets the atmosphere into the pictures. But things like light and settings and all that, and that can be all, I suppose, quite individual. But what sort of style of photography do you like? Is there a particular approach you have?
Honestly, I'm not afraid to try anything. And, you know, you can do that with digital. You know, I sound like a salesman or something. But, I'm not... For example, there are certain venues in the UK and further afield where you're more or less facing the sun. And that really should be fine because, yes, ideally you want an aircraft in perfect light, sun behind you, everything kind of illuminated beautifully. But on the other hand, why not actually have a bit more of a challenge? Why not try to pull out something really special? Yeah. So, and it very much depends on the day as well. The weather in this country is so unpredictable, for one thing, that you can have a plan. You can go to an air show and think, right, I really want to focus on this particular type of shot today. And it can really go to pot. So I just need to, I think one golden rule is know your camera settings inside out. You need to just have them on autopilot so you can adapt and so you don't miss the shot, basically.
So tell me, what's your favourite aircraft to photo? Is there a particular type or a particular model?
Particular aircraft to photo as opposed to favourite aircraft, full stop.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, all right, I'll ask you both. Give us both.
Okay. Favourite aircraft, full stop, would be, I'm a big fan of the kind of aerobatic types, so extras, pits, Sukhois, etc., etc., and the vintage aerobatic types, Linz, everything of that kind of calibre. They're not always that...
Yeah.
I mean, they're very nice to photograph, but there is, I suppose, a certain satisfaction that comes from a high-octane afterburning jet racing past, and you've got the photo. You know, you've got the photo with maybe vapour on the top wing or something like that. So, I mean, display teams as well. Display teams offer so many wonderful opportunities because of the smoke, and you can just have a lot of fun with that. So, yeah, I must say I do actually probably like photographing teams more than anything else, because alongside the aircraft, you've got this great canvas of smoke to play with as well. So, yeah, that can work well.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me, what's your best photo? What's the best photo or your favourite photo?
That is very tough. Not because there's a massive, massive number, but because it probably depends on certain days or they might be, you know, from a particularly good show that I remember really fondly.
Okay, what gave you the greatest buzz when you saw it, when you looked through your images and you thought, yes, caught it?
I think I would probably go to one particular place, and actually, funnily enough, it's not Biggin Hill, but go down to anyone that's been down to Dawlish, and I suppose this next bit's quite predictable, but you've got the classic... for anyone that doesn't know, Dawlish on the South Devon coast, very good air show and particularly good to, you know, to view. It's got some really quite special places. Not on this year, incidentally, but traditionally there are places you can photograph the aircraft, and I think everybody wants one particular shot. They want something really belting towards you or going away from you with kind of coastline in the backdrop. And there's a few of those. The first time I went was in 2008. There's a particular photo of a typhoon going away, afterburners blazing, a lot of kind of haze exhaust coming out too. So, yeah, that was quite satisfying because it's one that I still look back on now, and I suppose that would be up there, although there's probably others.
I know, that's a tricky one. And I've seen lots of your photos and they're pretty damn good, I have to say. So hats off for you to pick in one out. But you talked a little bit there about something I really want to get my teeth into now. You mentioned Biggin Hill.
Yeah.
And you've just written the history of Biggin Hill, the International Airfare. That's out now. Paul, tell me a little bit about the International Airfare. For example, I had no idea that Biggin Hill Airshow, as I would have called it, started off as an air travel fair.
It very much did, yes. It was an event that was put together really to kind of showcase views of air travel. I mean, at that time, Biggin Hill was, let's see, as a commercial airport, it was only 2-3 years old. The commercial license was awarded in 1959, I think. I have to check on that. There's a book I can look in somewhere. Right. And, so the two men at the time, who were Jock Maitland and Edward Drury, the people that founded the airfare, wanted to really put it on the map and thought, okay, what can we do? How can we get people to, you know, come to this very lively general aviation and commercial airfield that we're building up? So, yeah, it was. It was not meant to be anything like, for example, Farnborough. I mean, Farnborough was kind of British aviation showcase, but it wasn't specifically about air travel. So, yeah, they really hit on something new. And as you know, it became very, very popular thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, first year was 1963, and predominantly was airlines and civilian aircraft. But it ramped up in the following years very, very quickly. The military saw the benefit of putting their wares on show, and we started to see things like VC-10s, Tridents, and of course the Red Arrows start to appear, didn't we, in the sort of mid-60s.
And that, I mean, one great advantage there was, for so many years, it was the first show of the season. So, for example, the Red Arrows you've mentioned, but other new displays could premiere there. There was, you know, a great appeal, a great advantage to having people see your display in public for the first time. That also very strongly applies to the warbirds that began to populate the event in the early 80s and onwards. So, yeah, it did. It really kind of exploded into something much more than it was established to be.
And the way that you've written the book is a year-by-year account of each of the airfares. Now, when I was a young boy, I sort of had in my head the two air shows of Biggin Hill and Farnborough and sort of rotated between the two. But they were very different displays and air shows, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. They were. I think, for one thing, Farnborough has always been about showcasing the kind of newest designs in aviation. Biggin Hill's had its fair share of those too, but it much more started to become thematic and started to bring in aircraft related to particular themes and with them put on some quite spectacular showpieces. So it much more than Farnborough, it was a family show. There was always a great amount of things, not just aircraft, but attractions on the ground, and a lot of thought went into making it a really good day out for the archetypal family.
Yeah, and going through the 70s, and dare I show my age, was the sort of mid-70s I first went. You know, the early 70s was seeing 170,000 people at the air show. It's always been on around the same time, but it did shift, didn't it? It started off a bit later in the year, but it moved back.
Yeah, it did. It was, for so many years, either the kind of beginning or middle of May, and then there was a run of really bad weather events in the kind of early mid-80s. That moved it on to June. Ironically, that particular first June show had awful weather. That was the 87 air fare. And then, for various other reasons, yes, it moved to September for a couple of years, but generally I think you could probably say it's always been May or June.
And you talked about the 80s there. We started to see aircraft like Concorde and some of the aircraft, I suppose, we are familiar with more recently. The Americans started turning up in big numbers. I can remember seeing A-10s, F-16s, that sort of thing, and the F-111 there. And for me, at that time, Biggin Hill became more of a general attraction than Farnborough.
Yes, it very much did. I mean, you go back to even something like, I should know these things, but go back to the 71 show, and there was, you know, just four or five display teams, you know, at the one event. So I won't say always, because you've got to think of that very first show, but certainly from, say, the third or fourth airfare onwards, has always had that mixture, you know, to really try and appeal to the widest kind of cross-section that it could. And I think also there's another point to be made that they always tried to bring in something different every year as well. They tried to innovate. They very often did. And the kind of desire was always there to present the public with something new. And I think that's another really, really move. Airfare tradition.
Yeah, and things like Virgin Atlantic pitching up with the 747 doing a flyby, the Russians turning up in the mid-90s. But it wasn't all about new aircraft. Biggin Hill's got a rich heritage of older aircraft as well, you know, the B-17, the Sally B, and even in 1996. And I loved going through the book because it gave me such detail about some of the aircraft on display. A Vickers Vimy.
Yes, indeed, yeah. That was quite something. And that particular year, 96, had something really quite special. Biggin Hill had put on Battle of Britain-flavoured set pieces before, but in that year, they did something that actually was almost fictional, but it was involving what was then the old flying machine company, MiG-15, taking on a whole kind of battalion, really, of hunters. Now, that was what Biggin Hill and a lot of other post-war RAF bases could have been doing for real. They didn't, but you know, there's the airfare going out beyond history almost to bring something really quite special. So again, that desire to innovate, to do something that hadn't been done before, and to combine historic aircraft in a very unique way.
There was an airfare every year up until, what was was it 2010, 2011, every single year?
Yes, 2010. Well, there wasn't one in 2004. Because they just did a Battle of Britain weekend that particular year, but it's all 2010. Yes, 2010 was the last one.
Okay. And what happened? Why did it stop?
This is quite a complicated area. So it was run on a particular license. That license would have gone X number of years beyond 2010, and the airport did not renew it. Therefore, the airfare couldn't continue. That's the very kind of capped history.
But there's been a few small displays, and it sort of feels like it's coming back. We've got a show there this year, haven't we?
Yeah, the Festival of Flight, which will be in its third incarnation this year. I like it, to be honest. It's not the airfare, but it's a very good show. It has a bit of everything. Yeah. I'm just, you know, personally a massive fan of Biggin Hill. I just like to go back there, so I would honestly probably go back there for anything. But the Festival of Flight is a good day out. It doesn't pretend to be an airfare, but it does its own thing, and it does it very well.
Yeah. So why write this book then, Paul? Where did it come from? How did this all come about?
Okay. Personally, it was something that I just really wanted to do. I know that sounds very, very simplistic, but this is where I grew up. I was born and raised in Bromley, which is just down the road. And the airfare was really my inspiration. It was what got me into aviation. It was, I think you have to imagine, go back to a kind of 4 or 5 year old kid who just suddenly realizes that down the road every year is a great big international air show. You know, this was massively exciting to me. And I probably nagged and said, oh no, can we go? Can we go? And I did. And there's a bit of a kind of contention with my first airfare, 84, 85. I'm not sure. The family aren't quite sure either. But, you know, let's say mid-80s. And that got me hooked. From there on, I went to as many other shows as I could, but always, always would go back to Biggin Hill. Even when I moved away from the area, which was in 2005, that was always one of my return trips back home. I'd go and see the family and go to the airfare. So you could say I liked it.
So how many have you missed since then?
I couldn't get to one Festival of Flight. I wasn't well enough. Apart from that, every single one.
Wow. Okay. So you probably have lots of experience, knowledge, and of course, photographs from all the ones you've been to. What sort of research did you have to do to get some of the earlier information and some of those earlier pictures you've got in the book?
Sure. Well, yeah. So on the basis that I didn't go until, let's say, 85, there's, you know, 20 odd years of airshow history before that. So there was a lot of research involved. There really was. First of all, I got hold of every single program, every single brochure from each show, went through them pretty much word for word. You know, just ask my partner how many times, you know, a typical kind of front room night, you see me surrounded by books on the floor. You know, quite scary, really. But so every single brochure, as many magazine articles as I could, rewatched all the old videos I had. Watched an awful lot more on YouTube, that kind of thing. And also, I mean, I suppose the main thing was I was lucky enough to be let into what was the airfare office on Biggin Hill Airport. It's not the airfare office anymore. But at the time, they had quite extensive archives, and I was allowed to have a look in there. And so speak to some of the people that were involved. I wanted to interview particular pilots because I knew they would kind of help inform the particular areas that I wanted to focus in on. Yeah, so really a combination of magazines, books, videos, DVDs, online footage, archives, records, interviews, and recollections.
And before we go then, Paul, a name that is synonymous with the airfare is Jock Maitland. Tell us a little bit about Jock.
Amazing man, absolutely amazing man. I was lucky enough to interview him twice. This one was in, I've just mentioned it, I know, but in the airfare office. And he was utterly charming, very interested in the fact that I was doing the book. It still actually, you know, saddens me that he died before I could give him a copy. I really wanted to kind of say, look, it's done.
Yeah.
Here it is, you know, enjoy it. And it's all because of you. And thank you so much. But he was just a character as well, that should be said. He really was a very kind of very, if you think about a typical post-war English gentleman with quite a mischievous side, utterly charming, utterly delightful, but make no mistake, also a very, very, very good and astute businessman that got, I would say, pretty much what he wanted for the airfare, but did it in a very charming way.
Yeah. So he really brought the airfare to life and held it together for the majority of its life. Paul, what's your thoughts about the longer term for air displays or air shows or airfares at Biggin Hill?
I think it's such a kind of big catchment area. You've still got Farnborough, but as far as the southeast goes, yes, there's the shows, the seaside ones on the coast, but I think there will be Festival of Flights or thereof equivalents going on for quite a few more years. That said, of course, we're now in quite a difficult time for air shows anyway, so you would hope it would go on for a good few more years yet, but I honestly don't know, but fingers crossed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that note, Paul, where can we find out more about the book and you online?
Sure. The Airfare Book's got its own Facebook page. If you search on Facebook for Airfare Book, that should bring that one up. And personally, I'm on Twitter. If you look for @Fidster, FIDDSTER, that will bring me right up.
All right, and we'll put links to those in the show notes, along with a link to the book on the publisher's site as well. Paul, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
After the break, we talked to Mike Young about his video-based features on aircrew interviews.
Not another flying magazine. The newsagents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
Mike, welcome to Extended.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing very, very good. Thanks for speaking to us today. I want to learn a little bit more about aircrew interview. I've watched your programs, really enjoy it. But where did this all start? Where's your interest in aviation come from?
Well, it came from when I was younger. My dad went to the RAF and he tried to be a pilot when he was younger. And I think it was about 3 or 4 or something. And he took me to the air shows. And I remember one story he always told me is when the Jaguar took off, I always used to sit on the air blanket and cry, and which was a nightmare. And ever since then, I think I've just absolutely loved it. And then Top Gun, that he showed me that. And
yeah.
I absolutely loved it and it was amazing. And aviation since then has been part of my life.
Part of your life, what does that mean? What's your particular interest? Do you have a particular interest in a particular sector?
I'm not really sure, in terms of aviation,
Do you military, dad, jets, airliners?
Military jets is probably where I focus on, because I lived in America due to my dad's job. And I've been to Top Gun air show a few times, and seeing the Tomcat was absolutely amazing. I saw the F-14.
Oh, my God.
Which was incredible.
Yeah.
And we went there twice, and Luke Air Force Base as well. And that was when I was about 12 or 13 or something like that. And ever since then, I've been, carrying on the, tradition of wanting to see more jets.
Yeah, well, I saw F-14s a long, long time ago here, but I'd love to have seen them in their home territory. So tell us about aircrew interview. What is it and how did this come about?
Aircrew interview, I remember when I was, I think I was about 13 or 14, and I think that's when the internet started getting going, and I was looking for interviews with, fighter pilots.
Yeah,
and I could never really find anything. And I remember 14, 15, and I emailed an F-14 pilot, and he responded. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. And I was like, oh, answer my questions. I think the question was, have you ever been in formation with a tornado? Because that's one of my biggest things I want to see in life, a tornado and F-14 together. Right. And yeah, and then it went on, and I went to university, blah, blah, blah. And then about 2 years ago, I thought, YouTube, there's nothing there. And I thought, well, why not like make something of it? Yeah, interviewing fighter pilots and what have you. And it actually worked out to the point where, you know, like David Gledhill was my first one, and that's going really well at the moment.
Wow, that's a lucky first interview.
Yeah, yeah, it was
very, very popular. Dave was on the show with us, and I know in many other forums. How did you go about getting Dave Gledhill?
I was actually really, I don't know, you can't say cocky, but I was like, I was on Twitter. And I messaged him and I said, look, I've got this kind of idea, you know, interviewing fighter pilots and your story. And he messaged me back, and he was happy to do it. And we went to Newark, and it went great. And now it's on, I think it's on about 30,000 views right now.
Wow. Which excellent. Is great. Yeah, excellent. So tell us about some of the other guests that you've had on the show. I think you're up to, what, 10, 12 episodes now?
We're on 10 at the moment, yeah. Right. We released David Herriot, who's a Buccaneer nav, on the Sunday.
Enjoyed that, by the way. Love the Buccaneer.
Oh, yeah, it's a great aircraft, isn't it? Brilliant there. We've had Nick Ireland, we've had Phil Keeble, we've had a lot of people on. They talk about a lot of, you know, their experiences and stuff like that. And it's like a lot of people say like, oh, well, you know, it's the same aircraft or what have you, but their experiences like are amazing. Like you'll talk to people Nick Ireland, for instance, we were in a pub environment, and he told me everything, you know, like about the camera. And then we'll go to Paul McDonald, for instance, and we'll be in front of the camera. And it's amazing.
So tell us about setting up some of these interviews, because locations are quite important, aren't they? They add your atmosphere and backdrop to them. What sort of locations are you using? How are you photographing these?
For instance, I'll give you an example. This on the 20th of April this month, we'll be interviewing Rick Edward Peacocks, and that's it's really hard to describe it. You just message the people that you think will want you to be there, and they'll usually agree. Sometimes they want a bit of a donation, sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
But sometimes they're like just happy for you to come down and film. And if you give them, you know, a bit of a mention in the video, they're happy to, you know, welcome you.
And you like to use the aircraft that these people have flown in as an ideal setting, don't you, to photograph them. And you know, you mentioned there David Herriot, and part of the interviews in front of the aircraft, part of the interviews in the aircraft. And one of my most favouritest things is you get him to talk about what the cockpit setup is.
Oh yeah, I love that. Like that's like my favourite thing. If I can get into the cockpit and to talk about it, it's amazing, because you normally don't get that kind of view.
Yeah,
you know, just kind of interviewing someone in front of an aircraft. If you can, it's amazing. I mean, we did it with Phil Keeble as well.
Yeah,
he was talking about in the Hunter, and it makes all the difference.
And I'd like to think I knew a little bit about some of these aircraft, but they come up with these little anecdotes that you think, oh, I just didn't know that. And I didn't know the seats on the Buccaneer were offset so that they would eject in slightly different directions. It's fantastic.
Yeah, likewise. I didn't know that either. And when David was explaining, I was kind of like going in my head. I was like, oh, okay. Never even thought about it. So, yeah, but it's really interesting.
Developing on the idea of some of the interviews that you've had, Mike, I suppose, what's your ideal interview? Who would you like to interview that you haven't quite done yet? And what aircraft would you like to do that in?
I think a lot of people have emailed me and messaged me. They would like Ian Black. I think that would be like the biggest thing. But obviously, I know he's busy and stuff like that. So, but yeah, Ian Black on the Lightning, like doing a Lightning special would be quite, you know, quite special. So probably, Ian, I would say.
Talking a little bit about photography and videography, what sort of equipment do you use for recording these, Mike?
Well, I've got a Canon GM30, which is, it's classed as a prosumer camera, which is like on the verge of consumer to a professional camera.
Right.
And I use Rode mics, which is like, I would say like they're pretty, you know.
They're pretty decent.
They're pretty decent, yeah. And I've actually ordered myself a wireless mic, you know, the lapel mic.
Yep.
So, and a tripod, like a stable tripod. I use a Venban. They're pretty good, I would suggest, okay.
And what about post-production? What are you using to edit the video?
It's quite...
'Cause you need pretty powerful... processing equipment, don't you, for video? Audio's bad enough.
Yeah. I'm actually like, I'm quite simple. Like I'll use Windows Movie Maker, which is quite simple.
Yeah.
Or I'll use Corel.
Right. Okay.
Which is quite simple because I think no one wants to see like too many, you know, dramatic kind of like graphics or anything like that. I just want to get to the point for me. Like if I was like a viewer, so that's what I do. Yeah.
Well, let's move on then to talk a bit more about photography. It's a hard one to ask you because you're into video, but do you have a favourite that you've produced either on video or still? Do you have a favourite photo or favourite video?
I like that. There's one of Phil Keeble. In front of the Hawker Hunter in Bangor when I interviewed him in Wales, and that's I really like that one. He's in his like you know, black flight suit and black flight jacket, and it looks really good.
Right. Okay. And what's the most challenging video that you've had to take? You know, what are the sort of challenges that you face in getting a good shot and making it really attractive to the viewer?
I would suppose it's like when you're in a museum environment, the lighting can be a bit different. So, you know, if like you're in the back, like it can be, there's no light there and there can be people like walking around. So it's very, very difficult. But I would say the best in terms of like getting the best shot will be outside, even though,
right,
you know, like wind, you know, wind factor comes into it, but outside is probably the best, I would say.
And have you got any tips for our budding videographers out there who are probably getting their cameras ready for the air show season and fingers crossed a little bit of sun in this country? What tips have you got in terms of taking the best video and taking the best photography?
I would say just get your camera out, and as long as you're like enjoying it, I think that's the most important thing. Like rather than trying to be professional, I think if you're enjoying the display, get your camera out. I think that's the best thing I can say, really, like for me.
Mike, where can we find out about Aircrew Interview online then? Where can we find you?
Well, you can find us on Facebook if you go on the search bar and you search Aircrew Interview, and we have a page and we also have a group. So if you add us, you can like us on their page and you can also join the group.
Okay. Now, this is predominantly visual, so YouTube's where I track you down. Is that the best place to view the videos?
Yeah, there's also, like, we have a website, which is aircrewinterview.tv, which is gives all our interviews and it links you to YouTube.
Right, okay. And you love people to write in and give you suggestions and ideas, don't you?
Oh, of course, yeah. Like any suggestions of like types or, you know, ground crew, air crew, anything like that, we take it on board and we'll try and contact them people for an interview.
Right. And any plans to do anything outside of the UK?
Yes, I'm actually going to Lima, which is in Malaysia, in 2017. So I'm going to be doing that.
Right.
Which should be very interesting.
Wow. Yeah, that will be interesting. Any little snippets you can tell us about what you're looking to film out there?
Yeah, I'm looking to hopefully getting involved with, I guess, like Dassault, it would be quite good to talk to the pilots and that, and the RAF and BA Systems. So hopefully, but it's all up in the air at the moment, so we'll see.
Okay, well, fingers crossed on that one. You've got tens of thousands of views on your videos so far, so highly recommended that people go over and have a look if they haven't done. Mike, is there anything else that we missed while we were talking?
I don't think so. Just a pleasure to be on your channel.
Yeah, we loved having you, and we know you're very active on social media, so please do get out there and connect up with Mike and the aircrew interview team. Mike, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we heard from Paul Fidian and Mike Young there on aircrew interviews. Really innovative approach to video blogging, Tim.
Yeah, I mean, what a great idea. It's getting all these air crew, getting them in a museum and, you know, getting them to go through, you know, what it was like to fly these classic aircraft, you know, and get their stories on tape, you know. It's something that you know, obviously we try and do at the Aeronautical Society, but to have them in the actual museum and, you know, sort of stood next to a Buccaneer or stood next to a Tornado or what have you, and to kind of go through them and give, you know, the kind of cockpit brief, you know, brilliant idea. So it's interesting, you know, I was thinking about this about the other day, but there was, earlier today, there's something about, you know, sort of TV is declining, you know, TV news is declining you know, people are kind of going to the web and finding out content. And, you know, one of my personal sort of gripes is, oh, well, there's not enough aviation TV, you know, or aviation sort of related sort of, you know, television programs on the box. But then, you know, someone comes along like this and, you know, who actually needs you know, BBC or ITV or somebody to make it. You know, if you've got a decent camera, you've got a great subject, you've got a museum there, you've got the access, you know, you could now knock up, you know, sort of good documentaries, good, very, very interesting subjects. And, you know, that is the content that will draw people in. I was watching something else from a seniors club the last week, a seniors club in America, West Coast Seniors Club or something like that, and they had an X-29 test pilot on there giving a very, very technical brief. And it was amazing. Really, really good kind of, sort of video content.
Well, well done on that front, Mike. Rich, I just wanted to come back to you on Paul's book, the Biggin Hill International Airfare. Have you been to, well, no doubt you have been to Biggin Hill, but any success stories there in terms of photography?
No.
It's a hard place to take. I always found it a really hard place to take pictures.
Yeah. It was. I whenever I went to Biggin Hill, I was generally working on a stand, so I didn't really get to see much of it through a lens, which is...
Gareth, why...
Yeah, a shame.
Gareth, why do you say it was challenging?
Well, it's challenging for the light because of the position of the sun, in particular, which I have to say... and that is a kind of selfish photographer's perspective, because it is the most wonderful location.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
In terms of the flying display and, you know, the famous, you know, Biggin on the Bump. And, you know, naturally on a nice day, you know, you can see the City of London on the horizon. And I had some great air show moments there, you know. Anatoly Kovacher in the SU-27, and I saw my last Buccaneer solo display at Biggin Hill, which is a nice memory. Some great stuff, but it was I always found it a tough one for pictures, I have to say.
This is Max Flight. I love aviation podcasts. That's why I do Airplane Geeks, the UAV Digest, and the PAXX podcast. But when I need a break from creating my own shows, I turn to Extended. Peter, Tim, and Gareth do a stellar job and bring us all interesting and informative episodes. Extended, a great aerospace program.
Okay, and it's time for another X10 Top 10. So, on this episode, learning to fly and fight can be tough work. This week on X10 Extended, we look at the top 10 military trainers. Which one passed, which one's passed, and which one's washed out. At number 10, Fugier Magda. First flown in 1952, France's V-tail Fugier Magda went on to train the students of 25 countries with 929 built. The incredibly noisy Magda was also flying with the national air display teams of France and Brazil. Fun fact, despite having an incredibly short undercarriage, it was also converted into a carrier-capable trainer for the French Navy. And number 9, the Follard Gnat. Blessed with an eye-watering roll rate, the British-built Follard Gnat was the 60s hot rod that separated the men from the boys in the Cold War. Famously the first mount of the Red Arrows, the Gnat also had a second life as a lightweight fighter in India, where it was flown in combat against Pakistani sabres in the War of 1971. Fun fact, the Gnat also appeared in Top Gun's spoof Hot Shots. And number 8, de Havilland Canada Chipmunk. The follow-up to the Tiger Moth, the monoplane Chipmunk basic trainer first flew in 1946, and the production run eventually reached 1,283 with 20 military operators. They were also used in the UK to give air experience flights for ATC cadets until 1996. Fun factoid, the Chipmunk, which is 70 this year, also flew spy flights in Berlin during the Cold War. And number 7, North American T-6 Texan / Harvard. The first Boeing heritage aircraft ordered by the UK, the radial-engined North American T-6 Texan Harvard, trained thousands of Allied pilots during World War II. A step up from a biplane, the T-6 was a handful for a novice pilot. It was said that the docile handling Spitfire was the ideal lead-in trainer to the tricky Harvard. And number 6, Air Mackie MB-326. Flown by 14 countries, including Italy, Australia, Brazil and South Africa, the Air Mackie MB-326 advanced trainer first flew in 1957, becoming a bestseller. Like many advanced jet trainers, it also doubled in the light attack role, where it was used in combat by South Africa. And number 5, Aero L-39 Albatross, the Warsaw Pact advanced trainer of choice. The then Czechoslovakian L-39 was built in amazing numbers, some 2,900 with only over 30 air forces. Despite first flying in 1968, it is still in active service in a number of air arms today. Cheap to operate, it has also entered the private market as a jet warbird. It's flown by the Breitling Jet Team, among others. Fun fact, the L-39 had a cameo role in the 007 movie Tomorrow Never Dies. And number 4, the Northrop T-38 Talon. Amazingly, this supersonic T-38 advanced trainer has now been in service for over 50 years with its primary operator, the US Air Force. Some 1,146 were built, and the aircraft has also seen used by NASA as a chase plane, as well as the Turkish Air Force. Upgraded now to T-38C standard with glass cockpit, there's now a competition to select a replacement for this veteran trainer. And number 3, the BAE Systems Hawk. First flying in 1974, the BAE Systems, originally Hawk Siddeley Hawk, has become a British export success, with now over 1,000 ordered by 18 countries. Originally developed as a private venture, the Hawk was put into service as the RAF as an advanced trainer, as well as being flown by the Red Arrows. Most notably for a British design, it also won a crucial US Navy order for a carrier-capable trainer as the T-45 Goshawk. The latest UK version, the Hawk T-2, features a glass cockpit and synthetic training systems. And number 2, the Stearman Cadet. Think US World War II US primary trainer, and you'll invariably think of the Stearman Boeing Cadet. Some 10,620 were built, as well as training pilots for the US Army Air Corps and the US Navy. It also served in 19 other countries. As a first step in producing the huge amount of trained pilots the Allies needed to win World War II, the Cadet deserves its place on this list. And at number 1, It's the de Havilland Tiger Moth. And the primary trainer that also supplied pilots during a critical time in World War II. First flown in 1931, it was only retired in 1952. Some 8,868 were built, and as part of the Commonwealth training plan, the Moth also trained thousands of flyers in Canada. It was docile in handling, but still needed skill to fly well and do aerobatics. Ideal characteristics for a primary trainer. Still in private hands today, the Moth has stood the test of time. Fun fact number one, at the height of German aviation scares in 1940, RAF Tiger Moths were fitted with bomb racks with the idea they were going to bomb German invasion invasion beaches. Fun fact number two, the Tiger Moth may have become the first operational UAV drone with a Queen Bee radio control target. So that's my top 10. How about everyone else? Any missed off?
Very good, Tim. Very good. I thought for a second you were going to miss the Tiger Moth, but of course you didn't. Fokker Magister, never knew it was a carrier-qualified aircraft.
It's well, you know, you look at the undercarriage and that, I think, well, how the heck did they do that?
I know. it's pretty low, isn't it? It's pretty low.
It's also it's also really, really noisy.
Okay. Right, I didn't know that.
I loved the Magister. I thought it was a quirky-looking aircraft.
Yeah. Very photogenic, that one.
Yeah, definitely.
So low on the runway as well. The takeoffs they used to do, crumbs. Incredible.
There's definitely no ladder required to get in.
No, that's true. Yeah, that's it.
I thought Hawk was going to be number one, Tim.
I did.
First. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Controversy.
I'm not saying you were wrong. I just thought that's where it was going to be.
Tiger Moth has got a special place in my heart photographically as well. It's the first air-to-air I did. Oh, I don't know how, it must have been 15 or something ridiculous. I was shooting a Piper Cub, and I obviously didn't know that I was really airsick. So yeah, my lasting memory of a Tiger Moth is unfortunately losing my lunch over a newly restored walnut dashboard in the back of a Tiger Moth.
dearie me.
Didn't go down very well.
Well, if you agree or disagree with Tim on these X10 top 10, do contact us Twitter, Facebook, and by email.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so, to the Get Involved and Feedback section of the show, let's talk about our last couple of episodes, Shuttle Into the Black with Roland. Thanks for helping promote the episode, Isaac Alexander, Micah from Maine, Mehdi Azare, and Matt Willis. Amjad Zaidi, of course a guest on the show, said aviation have shot into orbit with the glory and the story of Columbia's first launch. Remember that day and listen to this. So thanks for that, Amjad. Stephen Woods said cheers, just listened to it and enjoyed it. And thanks very much for the mention. It made his morning. Tom Mercer, a few of us know Tom, I think, was listening to it whilst editing photos. So there you go. We'll have to make that part of one of your courses there, Rich. We got hundreds of likes and shares on that. So thanks to everyone for that support. We then went back to back on another episode, which also proved extremely popular. And that, of course, was Soviet Cold War fighters. Lots of feedback to quickly run through. Andy Ryan said, I've been watching loads of Soviet aircraft documentaries on YouTube over the past couple of months and really found this at the right time. Great show. So thank you very much, Andy. Dave Gledhill, really enjoyed it. Bert Danya, this was a great episode. Fantastic conversation between two aviation geeks of former Cold War opponent nations. And he put a winking emoticon there. So thanks very much for that, Bert. also Alex's photos as well proved immensely popular. So thank you very much for all your support, John Collier, Beverly, Dalton, Kirby. Those photos, the links to the shows, were seen by over 20,000 people for this single episode. So it really did prove popular. However, I did make one mistake, so thank you to Vasily Kuznetsov, who corrected a tweet that I posted on one of the MIG types. Hushkit
sounds like the man for that correction as well.
He does.
Yeah, he knows his stuff.
and he is a photographer too. I was going to try and have a chat with him before this episode, but alas, I didn't get to it. Hushkit enjoyed the latest episode, said it's his favourite so far. So thanks very much for that. And by the way, Hushkit has just put a new post up. They do like their top 10s too. And they've just put up their top 10 Beyond Visual Range fighters for 2016. So I'll put a link in that to the show notes. Always a good read, Hushkit, that blog. Yeah. Tim, we shared your pictures of your flight on in the MiG-29 as well with Chief Test Pilot Pavel Vaslov. That got an awful lot of comment as well. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that? Because I'm not sure we've ever heard that story.
So that involved a trip to Zhukovsky Air Base in 2006, courtesy of MiG. And a flight in a two-seat MiG 29 UB. It was bizarrely, it was a promotion, a competition they were running at Farnborough that year to name a manoeuvre by the MiG OVT, and I was judged to have won it with a Cossack power slide. and the prize was a go to Moscow, be wined and dined by MiG, and
sounds awful.
And go and have some amazing. So it was pretty surreal, you know. I mean,
wow.
I was you just kind of can't imagine it, that you'd be like, well, I'm going to a Russian test pilot center, you know, their secret version of kind of Boscombe Down. Stuart Edwards, and I'm going to go fly in a MiG-29. You know,
awesome. Bonkers.
Really, really good fun. Absolutely outstanding sort of experience. You know, really, really nice people. You know, and
you kept your lunch down.
Well,
is that a dig at me then?
it was pretty. I can sympathise with Rich here when he says that, you know, the air-to-air stuff is, my pilot, Pavel, he didn't even bother with a G-suit. You know, he's just that conditioned to G-force. And when you go flying, you know, jet fighter, you know, you think, oh, hang on, I've been on roller coasters before, and I've been on, humpback hills. You know, how hard can it be? And within sort of, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, you're there sweating. It's like you've been gone, nine rounds of Mike Tyson. You're thinking, God, this is a really like bad session at the gym. How do people, fly this, fight it? And also, if you're a test pilot, how do they take notes? How do they remember all this stuff? And with all this G coming on you come out there, you're sweating, your kind of face is white, and you've got new respect for the people who do this for day in, day out, for real, and come out there and still kind of have a conversation at the end of it.
Well done, Tim, and it proved popular when we shared that picture, so thanks very much for that. Okay, back to some general feedback. Steve Riley wrote to us and said we should look at getting a guest called Juanita Franzi from Aero Illustrations. This was following a post about some artwork on a fairy barracuda, actually, that she'd done. And I believe also does some artwork for the Aviation Historian. So we'll look into that, Steve. Thank you for that. Airport Spotting Bog shared the 10 most stunning airport approaches. And we asked if you agreed. Ian Allen came back and said, not at all. CNN voted New Zealand's Queenstown as the best approach. So not seen that one, so we'll have to take your word for that. Ian. And just finally, just before we move on to books and competitions, our best wishes go out to former guest and show supporter Jo Ayres. She recently underwent some surgery and we know she's recovering well, but our very best wishes go to you, Jo.
Yep.
Okay, books and book reviews. The Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club on Facebook. This month's header books are Jeanette Remack's, previous guest on the show, of course, To Slip the Surly Bonds, the XB-70 Valkyrie, and the Archangel and the Oxcart. So some great books to look up there. Talking of books, we've got three copies of Mark Van Hoenacker's book, Skyfaring, to give away. Now, Mark is a bestseller, Sunday Times bestseller. It won Book of the Year by The Economist, Book of the Week on Radio 4, as well as The Guardian, and was favourite book of the year from GQ. Probably one of the most eloquently scribed aviation books I've read. If you like flight, airlines, airliners, and you want to know what the experience of being an international airline pilot is like, then this is for you. Now, all you've got to do is send us a tweet or a message on Facebook with the hashtag AVBOOK, A-V-B-O-O-K, and the word Skyfaring. And we'll randomly select three winners before the next show airs. That's all you have to do. Random House will post you a copy directly. So tweet or message us the word Skyfaring and hashtag AVBOOK. Okay.
Can't recommend that.
Yeah.
Can't recommend Skyfaring highly enough, actually.
It is a fantastic book. I've got to say, I just couldn't put it down. Lovely way of writing he has. Okay, over to promoting aerospace. Our second giveaway today is for the official AO size and A3 versions of the 2016 Air Day poster. Now, that poster reflects this year's show. And, of course, we've been there for the last 3 or 4 years. We'll be there again this year, July the 2nd. So if you're going to be there too, then post your favourite Air Day photo on our Facebook or Twitter page, linking the official Yeovilton Air Day page, and we'll choose a winner before July. And we'll bring your poster along to the show. We'll get a few words from you. But do remember to link up to the official page. That's Yeovilton Air Day. We want your best photos from Air Day. Have you been to Air Day, Rich? Yeovilton, got any good shots?
Yeah.
You're not allowed to enter, by the way.
No, <that's cool. laughs> I can recall the Master Salt from kind of like, you know, the late 80s and the 90s. So, you know, seeing sort of 40, 50 helicopters and a dozen Sea Harriers attacking the place. I think those are probably tucked away in the loft somewhere, unfortunately. I need to get them out and have another look at them. But yeah, got some great memories from Yeovilton.
Okay, excellent. We'll get your pictures posted up on our pages and you get the chance to win that poster. Okay, some shout outs. Space Up UK. This is an excellent opportunity if you're interested in space and can get to King's College London on the 3rd or 4th of June. The event set up like an unconference, which means that instead of sitting through lots of talks and lectures, you get to decide what gets talked about and, most importantly, take an active part in talking and joining in the space debates. I've heard a lot about these. They're very, very popular. They're only £20 per person, half price if you're a student. So if you're interested in that, we'll put a link in the show notes for you. Tim, any shout outs?
Last time we were on Extended, I had a movie recommendation for Last Man on the Moon.
Proved very popular. Yeah.
Excellent, superb documentary. I've got another one here. I've not actually personally myself, but I think it's well worth going and seeing. That is Eye in the Sky. If you're interested in the ins and outs and the ethics of remote warfare, you know, Reapers, drones, predators, and how the kill chain might work in a kind of a fictional situation. It's getting really good reviews. It sounds a really interesting movie to see about kind of modern warfare and, you know, some of the sort of ethical legal dilemmas that kind of come up when you are, you know, using kind of drones.
Right. Okay. Look, sounds quite interesting, actually. Gareth, any shout outs?
Yeah, I just wanted to give a mention to the Anglo-American Lightning organization, who are battling away to return Lightning T5 XS422 to the air in the United States, because unfortunately she won't be able to fly in the UK for regulatory reasons. Amazing looking aircraft. We're familiar to a lot of people, this particular one as well, because she flew the Empire Test Pilot School at Boscombe Down for quite some time. I don't know about you, I'd love to see another Lightning in the air. It probably is still the aircraft for me from when I was growing up. They've got a Kickstarter funding campaign going on at the moment. They've had a lot of money pledged, but they have got a way to go, and not a massive amount of time. But please, please go and visit www.lightning422supporters.co.uk. All the information is there.
Wonderful. Good shout out. Love to see her back in the air. I did talk to those guys, gosh, about 4 or 5 years ago before they left for the States, and it seemed like a monumental task. Truth be told, I never thought they'd get to the point they're at now.
They have made genuine progress.
Yeah, they've worked incredibly hard on that, haven't they?
So great shout out. Okay, that's about all we've got time for. So we'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can find Extended now on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, thepoddirectory.com, and of course on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, but please do ask before using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society, www.aerosociety.com, or you can find me twittering at RESTimR.
Gareth, where can we find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Gareth_Stringer, and everything global aviation resource related is still at www.globalaviationresource.com.
And Rich, reminder where we can find you and Co-op.
So Co-op is on centreofaviationphotography.com and Co-op Photo on Twitter. Myself, I've got a Facebook page of RC Pro Photo, and Co-op as well is also on Facebook with a very active community. And my own personal Twitter handle is at Dickie Coops.
You can find me at Mascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. Okay, that's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Rich Cooper.
Goodbye. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
It's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everyone. See you next time.
And goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Bye, all. Thanks. Thanks so much, Peter. It's good to be back.
Great to have you back. And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extend it.
This is XTP Media.